From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
أنا أتمنى إنه يحاكموا كل مجرم.
I believe that any criminal must be brought to justice, unjust action.
والعدالة إن شاء الله سوف تحصل.
And hopefully justice will take its course.
A survivor of the massacre of hundreds of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps more than close to 20 years ago demands that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon be brought to justice. A Belgian court postpones the hearing. The UN says it will continue economic sanctions against Iraq, and the Bush administration warns Iraq it faces attack unless it readmits UN weapons inspectors. We'll talk with a former UN weapons inspector, Scott Ritter. And as UN-led talks on Afghanistan's future government continue in Bonn, Germany, we'll speak with a Somali activist about the role women have played in her country's reconstruction and why she's convening the first Afghan Women's Congress this weekend in Brussels. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. warplanes continued to bomb the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar yesterday as coalition-backed opposition forces moved toward the southern city and closed in on suspected hideouts of Osama bin Laden in the east of Afghanistan. In the eastern city of Jalalabad, local commanders said the U.S. government has promised military supplies, logistical support, and money to Mujahideen fighters in anticipation of an assault on an al-Qaeda hideout in the White Mountains, where bin Laden is rumored to be hiding. As pressure mounts on the Taliban, many of the former regime's officials fled Kandahar for Pakistan, ostensibly to visit their families, but presumably with no intention of returning. The stories of rising defections came as the Taliban supreme leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, ordered his followers to fight to the death to preserve control of Kandahar. The British Foreign Office yesterday ruled out an inquiry into the mass killings of Taliban prisoners during the riot at the Kalaijangi Fort, despite pressure from Amnesty International and the United Nations. Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said many unanswered questions remain about the 3 days of fighting around the prison complex near Mazar-e Sharif. The incident left an estimated 400 people dead, at least 150 of which were Taliban prisoners apparently executed by Northern Alliance troops while U.S. advisors were present. Some newspapers are reporting that the two CIA men who were there questioning the prisoners provoked the uprising. One of those men was killed. Negotiations on Afghanistan's future were dealt a blow when a prominent Pashtun delegate walked out, charging that the ethnic majority Pashtuns were not given enough clout in the new administration. Haji Abdul Qadir was the most senior Pashtun figure in the delegation representing the powerful Northern Alliance and was central to the efforts by the grouping, which is dominated by minority Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, to present itself as representative of the country's complex ethnic patchwork. Qadir's exit came as delegates entered the crucial phase of finalizing lists of delegates to a parliamentary-style Supreme Council, part of a UN blueprint that also provides for a cabinet-style interim administration. Hopes of an agreement were boosted yesterday when the Northern Alliance relaxed its earlier opposition to an international peacekeeping force being sent to Afghanistan. The UN Security Council met last night to agree on a revised plan for sanctions against Iraq amid controversy over U.S. threats to attack Iraq as part of the so-called war on terrorism. We'll be speaking with former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter in a minute. A bomb explosion on a bus in northern Israel has left at least four people dead, including the suicide bomber responsible for the attack. The latest attack comes on the fourth day of a mission to the region by U.S. envoys who are hoping to secure a ceasefire and implement a peace deal. Earlier yesterday, Israeli troops shot and killed two Palestinians at a roadblock in the West Bank, not far from the site of the bus attack. U.S. peace envoy Anthony Zinni strongly condemned the Palestinian attack, but said nothing about the killings by Israeli troops. The Justice Department announced yesterday foreigners who give investigators useful information about terrorists will be rewarded. Under the new Responsible Cooperation Program, the Justice Department will defer deportation indefinitely for immigrants with visa problems and will allow outsiders to enter the country and apply for citizenship if they participate in this program. Arab groups and immigrants criticize the program. Marwan Kredi, executive director of the Philadelphia Arab American Community Development Corporation, said it's bribery and it's disgusting. It's what I would think some authoritarian government in the Middle East would do. President Bush yesterday defended his controversial plans to let military tribunals try non-citizens accused of terrorism and to let law enforcement officials detain and question thousands of foreigners in the United States. Bush brushed aside criticism of the measures, which have been widely condemned as violations of basic civil liberties, saying they would help protect freedom. And Attorney General John Ashcroft said yesterday that Clayton Wagner is the primary suspect in a wave of anthrax hoax letters sent to women's health clinics on the East Coast. Wagner claimed responsibility for some 300 letters delivered to clinics last month when he showed up with a gun at the Georgia home of an anti-abortion activist last week. Wagner had previously been jailed on firearms and theft charges, testified at his trial that he had stalked clinics for months and stocked up on weapons after God asked him to, quote, be my warrior and kill doctors who provide abortion. It was the first time that the Attorney General John Ashcroft publicly addressed the issue of the number of threats that women's health clinics have received around the country. Attorney General John Ashcroft has said before he became Attorney General that it would be his greatest accomplishment to help have passed a constitutional amendment banning abortion.
Love is old, love is new. Love is old, love is you. Because the sky is blue, it makes me cry. Because the sky is blue,
the Beatles. George Harrison died yesterday afternoon after a long battle with lung cancer. He was 58 years old. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN Security Council met last night to agree on a revised plan for sanctions against Iraq amid controversy over U.S. threats to attack Iraq as part of the so-called war on terrorism. Russia, which has previously blocked British and U.S. proposals for what U.S. officials call smart sanctions, backed a compromise deal under which a new list of the items controlled by sanctions will take effect in June. In the meantime, existing sanctions will continue. The Iraqi government, meanwhile, rejected a demand from President Bush to allow United Nations weapons inspectors back into the country as long as economic sanctions remain in place. The prospect of U.S. attacks against Iraq was heightened Monday after Bush said the U.S. would expand the so-called war on terrorism to include nations that, quote, develop weapons of mass destruction that will be used to terrorize nations. Bush administration officials and even some Democrats have called for the U.S. to move on to Iraq after Afghanistan, saying the country is linked to the September 11th attacks, to recent bioterror attacks, or to terrorism more generally. Asked specifically whether the U.S. would invade Iraq if it continued to deny access to international weapons inspectors, White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said the president left that for Saddam Hussein to figure out. General Colin Powell played down talk of attacking Iraq in the immediate future after remarks by President Bush about possible military action sparked widespread concern among U.S. allies and condemnation in the Muslim world. We turn now to Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq who resigned 3 years ago in protest. We welcome you to the War and Peace Report.
Well, thank you.
So what is your assessment of these latest developments?
Well, it's there's a lot to be concerned of. We have a group of people in Washington, D.C., in the Bush administration who have a personal vendetta against Saddam Hussein's Iraq. This is Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy, John Bolton, the Undersecretary for Arms Control. And it appears that they are going to take advantage of the war on terror to settle their grudges. This is an ideologically driven event. They have yet to make a case that Iraq currently presents a threat to the national security interests of the United States, the region, the world, the kind of threat that would warrant, an expanded military campaign of the sort that has been bandied about. So I'm very concerned because this appears to be, driven by rhetoric, not driven by fact. And in the current environment amongst public opinion, which is rallying around the war on terror, I don't think people are making the distinction between the two.
I'm not sure if everyone understands your history. You were one of the most controversial experts on Iraq, a former weapons inspector in Iraq. You didn't quit because you protested U.S. policy being too tough on Iraq, but you felt that the weapons inspection program wasn't working. And then afterwards, you started, it seemed, to turn around. Can you explain what your position was?
Well, actually, there's been no turnaround or change in my position. I've always been a proponent of the law. And if you're going to pass a law, in this case, the Security Council of the United Nations passed a law requiring Iraq to be disarmed to a 100% level, and then form a group to implement the law, and that was the weapons inspectors, then you have to support this group. If our job was to go into Iraq and carry out disarmament inspections, and we did this for 7.5 years. We struggled against a combination of Iraqi deceit, of Security Council indecisiveness, and American manipulation. Keep in mind, the United States has had a policy since 1991 of containing Saddam Hussein until which time they can find the means to remove him. And, that's not my job as a weapons inspector. When I resigned, I highlighted the difficulties. I likened it to, passing a law on speed control. You put up a signpost that says, 40 miles an hour, and you put a cop out there with a radar gun, and people zip by at 70, and the cop picks them up on the radar and doesn't stop them. Well, this is ludicrous. If you're going to pass a law that says 40 miles an hour, then you need to enforce the law. If not, change it to reflect what you're willing to enforce. In the case of disarming Iraq, the Security Council passed a law that said 100% disarmament. We did not achieve that. We achieved a 90 to 95% level. And as a weapons inspector, I didn't have the wherewithal to say that's good enough. So we pushed to get the final 5 and 10%. And we got bogged down in that. When I resigned, I talked about if you're going to have inspectors, then you need to respect the law that they're called to implement. Now, this all went away in December of 1998 when the United States continued to manipulate the weapons inspection process to provide a justification for their unilateral military strike of, Operation Desert Fox. Since that time, I've been saying because the U.S. discredited the law, that 100% level standard, is no longer applicable. No one can talk about getting inspectors back in to do what I was doing. The Security Council won't back that. Iraq won't back that. The weapons inspection process has been discredited. So you need to talk about a new standard. And the new standard that I talk about is this qualitative standard that accepts that 90 to 95% of verified disarmament meets the intent of the Security Council to rid the world of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs.
I remember when you quit, you were all over all of the airwaves talking about how Iraq hadn't totally disarmed. At about the same time, Dennis Halliday quit the United Nations. He was Assistant Secretary General, and he was in charge of the Oil for Food Program of Iraq, and he called the sanctions regime genocidal. He got almost no attention. Now, when I turn to CNN, I don't see you at all talking about criticizing U.S. foreign policy at this point, saying that the 90 to 95% is adequate to honor the spirit of the law.
Well, as I said, you know, that is the reality. We can no longer talk about getting weapons inspectors back in for the purpose of achieving a 100% level of disarmament. I think it's clear that the Security Council and most of the rest of the world understand that that process was corrupted by the United States, and any new weapons inspection process, you know, must take into consideration Iraq's legitimate national security concerns. You can't have inspectors going in to, spy on Saddam Hussein. You can't have an inspection process that facilitates regime removal instead of disarmament. And, you know, this is what I'm talking about. This is a new, calculus that it talks about fundamental levels of disarmament, qualitative levels, and talks about getting inspectors back into Iraq, not to hunt down the final vestiges of these programs, but rather to monitor Iraq to ensure they never again reconstitute.
What do you think of the Bush administration saying Iraq could be next, and people like Wolfowitz of the Pentagon pushing hard for an attack on Iraq?
Well, again, I think that what we're seeing here is a group of ideologically driven Saddam baiters hijacking the national security of the United States. These people have a decades-long personal agenda to remove Saddam Hussein from power. I respect their agenda. Saddam Hussein's a brutal dictator, that's fine, except that, you know, the reality is there is no support for removing Saddam Hussein, and the process of removing Saddam Hussein is actually counterproductive for, you know, American national security, for regional national, for the world security. So, you know, but these guys, you know, this is their personal agenda. This is what they're about. And I wish people would wake up and understand that, you know, we're letting a handful of policy wonks let their personal agenda determine, you know, how our nation is going to behave. And this is a mistake.
We're talking to former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, who quit in 1998. I've been watching Richard Butler a lot on television, the former head of UNSCOM, the UN weapons inspection program, your boss at one time. He said it's a waste of time to comment on your claims, Scott Ritter, that Iraq is effectively disarmed as far as UN resolutions are concerned and doesn't pose a serious threat to its neighbors. And in a feature piece in the conservative Weekly Standard, Stephen Hayes called you an American apologist for Saddam Hussein. We tried to get him on the air. We called him many times. He didn't return our calls. How do you respond to these charges?
Well, I mean, how should one respond? This is clearly an effort to attack the messenger and avoid addressing the message. If you read Stephen Hayes' piece, and I tried to point this out in the one time I had an opportunity to go face-to-face with him, he totally misrepresents everything I've said, everything I've written. It's a very clever editorial parsing of my words. He uses an interview I gave with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, he conveniently avoids to put the paragraph above the quote and below the quote that puts everything into perspective. That's just the way the guy, you know, did it. He removed sentences from passages so that it appears that I'm saying something that I wasn't saying. Richard Butler, you know, I have to respect Richard Butler's right not to want to address a topic which is exceedingly difficult for him to deal with. You know, when I talk about Iraq and when I write about Iraq, I deal with documented fact. Richard Butler has divorced himself from documented fact, and he deals with rhetorical speculation that seems to be ideologically driven. I'd love to have the opportunity to talk about this with Richard Butler, to debate him on any global stage he wants to, on television, in front of a crowd, anything. He's, you know, assiduously avoiding such, you know, such a confrontation, because the fact of the matter is he can't, you know, be confronted with the difficult truth of what he represented while he was the chief inspector, the executive chairman, of how his actions undermined the efforts of the weapons inspectors, and what the actual reality of Iraq's disarmament was. Richard Butler knows what the facts are, and today he chooses to conveniently ignore these. And he brushes this off by saying, he doesn't have the time to deal with me, so be it.
How did you become aware, Scott Ritter, of the effect of the sanctions on the people of Iraq?
Well, you know, as a weapons inspector, we weren't there to carry out humanitarian work. It's not as though we were, you know, our job is to go into the factories and the military facilities and the government facilities and search for information that pertained to weapons programs. Dennis Halliday, who you mentioned, and Hans von Sponeck and others who worked at humanitarian programs, I think they had a spotlight on, you know, the humanitarian difficulties. We had, as weapons inspectors, we were peripherally exposed to this. Of course, you saw the poverty in the streets. You saw the empty markets. You saw, things that indicated that Iraq was not a healthy society. But I'd say that I was educated, you know, one, because I have an abiding interest in Iraq, so I took the time to learn about what was going on while I was doing the weapons inspection. And two, listening to people like Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck talk about this, I hold them in the highest regard. They're men who, have extremely high standards of integrity, who aren't given to exaggeration, and they've opened my eyes to the reality of what's going on inside Iraq. But again, just as an American Marine, a former Marine, we're trained always to protect civilian populations, even in the times of conflict. You have to go out of your way to avoid, bringing harm to civilians. And when you apply that to Iraq, no matter what your, feelings are about Saddam Hussein and his regime, the fact is, to have a program of economic sanctions which holds an entire population of innocent civilians hostage to, because of the crimes of one man or a group of men, that's not sound policy. That's not morally correct policy. That's not what I was trained to be about. So, even if I wasn't equipped with the details of the humanitarian suffering, the details that Dennis Halliday might have, I am a moral enough human being to understand that the basic policy itself is flawed morally, flawed fundamentally. It's not achieving its objective. It's
Scott Ritter, last question. That is, since you haven't been there and the weapons inspectors haven't been in Iraq for the last few years, how can you say at this point that Saddam Hussein does not have dangerous biological and chemical weapons?
Well, first of all, I don't think I've ever said that Saddam Hussein does not have dangerous biological and chemical weapons. I've said we don't know what he has right now because we don't have weapons inspectors in. What I can say is, as of December 1998, the programs that Iraq had in place in 1991 to produce biological, chemical, nuclear, and long-range ballistic missiles had been destroyed, dismantled. The weapons themselves destroyed. Now, there was some uncertainties, but this was primarily an accounting issue. We talked about being unable to verify that everything was accounted for. This didn't mean that there was a massive program hiding behind the next hill. No, those programs were gone. And we know what it takes to build these programs. It took decades, billions of dollars, and access to the highest technology. And no one has been able to show that Iraq has acquired this technology, has been able to spend the amount of money required, and has actually reconstituted the infrastructure. So it's highly unlikely that Iraq has rebuilt in any meaningful fashion its weapons programs. But we won't know what's going on in Iraq until we get weapons inspectors back in, and we're not going to get them in by President Bush waving a magic wand and demanding them. We're going to have to go to the Security Council. We're going to have to strike a deal, and this deal will probably include the lifting of economic sanctions in exchange for the return of monitoring inspectors. That's the best deal we can get, and that's a good deal. That's one that will accomplish the intent of the council and alleviate the suffering of the Iraqi people.
Scott Ritter, I want to thank you very much for being with us, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll find out what happened in a court in Belgium where the survivors of the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in southern Lebanon want to bring Ariel Sharon into court. Stay with us.
Dangerous rhymes perform like surgery, cut so deep, do we bleed in burgundy? My intellect racks and disconnects, your cerebral cortex, your cerebellum is next. Your conscience becomes subconscious, soon your response is nonsense. The last words were heard, mumbled and slurred, then your words are no longer heard. You get your lung fried, so put your tongue tied. He couldn't swing a hang, so he hung till he died. Reincarnate him and kill him again, again and again, again and again. I leave him in the mausoleum so you can see him. I got a dead MCing museum. When I create him, I cremate him and complicate him. You can't save him, there's no ultimatum. Mics lay around full of ashes, with the victim's name in slashes. I got a long list and I'ma get every one of ya. Beware of the Punisher.
The Punisher, Eric B. and Rakim here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Belgian legal panel Wednesday postponed hearings in a case charging Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon with genocide. The plaintiffs are survivors or families of victims of the hundreds of Palestinians massacred at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon in 1982. They accuse Sharon of responsibility in those massacres. The suit against the Israeli Prime Minister was brought under a 1993 Belgian law which allows war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide to be tried in Belgian courts, regardless of where the alleged crimes were committed or the nationality or residence of the victims and accused. The hearing came a few months after a series of documents, including minutes of meetings between top-ranking Israeli and Lebanese military officials, were anonymously delivered to the lawyers representing the Palestinians. The lawyers say the documents provide watertight evidence that there was a conscious and effective chain of command between the Israeli military and the right-wing Lebanese militia, which carried out the slaughter. We're joined on the telephone now by Shibli Malat, one of the lawyers representing the Palestinians suing Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for genocide. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. You're now in France, having come from Belgium, where the court hearing took place on Wednesday. Did you find anything encouraging in that in the court's ruling?
Well, the court hasn't ruled yet. It's still in the midst of pleading. And for the first time, there is something symbolic about the victims bringing their voice through their lawyers to a neutral and independent court for a crime against humanity. But the court was very encouraging insofar as the Attorney General, the equivalent of the highest prosecuting body, judicial body in Belgium, supported all the arguments that the victims had brought forward through their lawyers, that Belgium should proceed with the case because it is the case that falls under the law of 1993.
And can you talk about exactly who you represent?
Well, we represent, originally, it's a lawsuit that is brought by about 28 people. For procedural reasons, they were divided between witnesses, five of them, and 23 plaintiffs. Most of these people have lost several members of their family, and they do represent a large spectrum of Lebanese and Palestinians who lost one or more members of their very close family during the 3 days of massacres in Sabra and Shatila in September 1982.
For listeners who weren't familiar with what happened at the time, can you explain exactly what you are alleging and what Ariel Sharon's responsibility is?
Well, the law is one of those that are known as universal jurisdiction laws, and that is a law that considers that there are such crimes that are so dramatic, so massive, so callous, so systematic, so civilian-directed, that they concern the whole of humanity, These are called crimes against humanity. Now, there are various versions, but the law in Belgium is very well crafted. It includes genocide, crimes against humanity as such, and the war crimes. So what happened in Sabra and Shatila partakes of all three, and the complaint was brought on the 18th of June of this year under the three heads of accusation against Charon and all others, Lebanese or Israeli, who will be found responsible by the judge for those massacres. The reason why Charon in particular has been singled out is because under international law, the person who is in a position of command is one who obviously is more responsible than even the executioners, because it is under his aegis that the massacre has taken place.
I'm just going to read from The Guardian, the British newspaper, a piece by Julie Flint that was written this week, the day of the Belgian court hearing. And it says, it's September 19th, 1982, the day after the Lebanese forces militia left Beirut's Palestinian camps after a 38-hour orgy of killing. And it is finally possible to see what the Israeli soldiers surrounding the camps claim they had been unable to see. Streets carpeted with bodies, men, women, and children shot and hacked to death, pregnant women eviscerated. In Christian East Beirut, Israel's chief of staff, Lieutenant General Rafael Eitan, the commander of the Northern District, Major General Amir Drouri, and a senior Mossad officer, Menachem Navot, codenamed Mr. R, meet the deputy chief of staff of the Lebanese forces, Antoine Bredi, Toto, and Joseph Abu Khali, the man who made the first contact with the Israelis in March 1976. What ensues is a cynical damage limitation conference in which senior officers of the Israeli Defense Forces utter not one word of reproach for a massacre in which militiamen trained, armed, and sent into the camps by them killed at least 900 defenseless civilians. These documents that The Guardian is reporting on uncovering, how did you get a hold of them that show the Israeli chain of command with the Lebanese militia?
Well, sometime in early July, so about 3 weeks after the complaint was lodged, a huge package was received by my colleague, Matt Wallain, who with me is prosecuting this case for the victims. There was no source, but these were documents in Hebrew and in English, which clearly referred to some which were taken for very sensitive meetings, including the Israeli intelligence with senior members of the militias who perpetrated the effective killing. And so we don't know what the source is, and we presume it is probably Israeli.
And what were some of these documents exactly? What other things did they show in addition to document this meeting that I just described?
Well, these documents show quite a lot of things. Of course, there are a lot of names that until then had not been connected at all with the massacres, including, for instance, Mr. Navot, whose name recurs and who seems to have been one of the senior, if not the chief, of Mossad in charge in Beirut, the Mossad being obviously the Israeli intelligence services. But mostly what we think these documents show is that there is a very remarkable chain of command whereby the Falangists for a long time, way before the massacres and even after the massacres, were doing exactly what the top people in the Israeli army were telling them to do.
We're going to go now to one of the survivors of the massacre who lost 15 members of her family. Her name is Wada Sabek, and the Democracy Now! In Exile producer Chris Abrams spoke with her about her reaction to the court hearing, but specifically about her own experience with you, Shibli Malat, translating. This is what Wada Sabek had to say.
On 17th of September, they came and they told us that they were
that they were stamping the passport so that you go away. I was with my children at home. They took us to the entrance of Shatila. They took my kids from me and my brother and all our neighbors, our cousins and close relatives, the young men. And they took us, me and my little kids, to the Cité Sportive, to the sports center. They left us until 7 o'clock in the evening. They told us to go to a place called Sakhani. We stayed on the bridge of the Kola with my children. And then they bombed, they started shelling Sakhani. We slept in a desolate building until dawn. So then I went to the sports center and I started asking, where are the young men, where are my two boys? So the Israeli said, you go to Abu Ammar and you get them from there. Then a woman came and told us to go to see those killed corpses at the entrance of Shatila. So we went and I saw my nephews and my gender and kids mutilated, young men, women, hundreds of
them.
Then we saw the civil institutions there going and digging a big grave and putting. And the Red Cross, 35 people from the Medad family were taken. There were also Syrians, our neighbors, about 10 people also killed.
Did you lose members of your family?
My two boys and my brother. And my gender and my cousin, about 15 people from the family, from the extended family.
And how does it make you feel that Ariel Sharon is now the Prime Minister of Israel?
I believe that any criminal must be brought to justice, not just Ariel Sharon. And hopefully justice will take its course with the help of God.
Wada Sabek, survivor of the massacre at Sabra and Shatila. She lost 15 members of her family, translated by Shibli Malat, who is on the telephone with us right now, one of the lawyers representing the Palestinians suing Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for genocide, for responsibility for that massacre. He was the general in charge of the Israeli army that surrounded the camps when the Falangists, the Lebanese militia, moved in and killed the Palestinian refugees in the camps. Shibli Malat, as we wrap up, the lawyers representing Ariel Sharon in court on Wednesday said that the Belgian law that allows you to sue the general for crimes against humanity is discriminatory because it allows anybody to be sued by anybody else. Can you explain their argument?
Well, I mean, we're not talking about normal crime. And so we're talking about a very specific type of crimes, which are so massive, so dramatic, within the context and the magnitude. Perhaps for an American audience, the closest example of Sabra and Shatila is what happened on September 11th, where over 4,000 civilians were killed wantonly in an act of sheer brutality.
Are you speaking on a speakerphone?
Pardon?
Are you speaking on a speakerphone?
No, I am not.
Oh, sorry. If you could just come close to the phone as you can.
Right.
Good. Thanks. You're saying maybe people could understand it by comparing it to the September 11th attacks.
That's right, yes. I mean, the magnitude, the nature of the people, the wantonness in which it was done is one that suggests that the persons who were in a command responsibility, in other words, somebody like Sharon, without whom this massacre would not have taken place, he did give the order for the Falangists to go to the camps and clean them up from terrorists, is something that should stand in good understanding for someone who has witnessed a similar crime against humanity as happened in New York on the 11th of September.
It's interesting because it was Ariel Sharon, now as Israeli Prime Minister, who said after the September 11th attacks that now maybe Americans can understand what it means to feel like an Israeli.
Well, it's up to the, you know, to the selective memory, of course, of criminals is one which is particular. What I think is more accurate is on the receiving end of things, to see how a massive crime goes unpunished, and while it doesn't absolve people who are wantonly killing innocent civilians in Israel and elsewhere, I find it hard to see how Mr. Sharon, who was found even by his own kin, the Israeli commission known as Kahani, as personally responsible for the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, to be able to so selectively describe things with regard to September 11th.
Finally, Mr. Malat, what happens with the court case now?
Well, we have another two sessions, after which the court must decide about the opportunity and the legality of pursuing the charges in Belgium. And they're confident, after the Attorney General has backed our positions, that the court will take the same view and allow the prosecution to continue.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And if people want to get more information on the case, you can go to malat.com. That's MALLAT.com, the last name of the lawyer we're speaking to. Shibli Malat, speaking to us from France, where he and Wada Sabek have gone from Belgium to speak with French human rights groups. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to a Somali activist to talk about women involved in the reconstruction of her country and why she is now leading the first Afghan Women's Congress in Belgium this weekend. Stay with us.
Take another look into Africa, the black land they call our cable line. Here is a story, the teachers of our former glory, of queens and warriors, women strong and brave, refused to be subdued or taught how to behave. They clearly understood the power within comes from God and should not be dictated by men. So rule the nation seated on a throne. Don't let them battle fighting to protect their home. So study nature, the science of healing, religion and the arts reflect their deepest feeling. Music, the list is practically endless. The contributions we have made are quite timeless. In almost every category you will find us singing or playing instruments. Upon the world we make our mark, we make a serious dent. We have influence of sound. We offer soul that nowhere else can be found. Touching of feelings that are rich and profound. Words, let's talk about some writers who use the pen and pages, weapons of a fighter. Educating through their poetry and prose, their essays and the novels and the stories that drove a message.
Women should be a priority, sweet honey in the rock, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. The second Ground Zero is now Afghanistan. I'm Amy Goodman. UN-led talks on Afghanistan's future government continue in Bonn, Germany today as representatives of the country's ethnic groups and military factions try to cobble together a transitional government. Afghan women are demanding a role in these talks as well, hoping to end 20 years of systematic exploitation and their near total exclusion from Afghan political life. It's a daunting task, bringing peace to an impoverished Islamic country that's been devastated by drought, invasion, civil war, and most recently U.S. bombing, and ripped apart by local patriarchs who've manipulated religion and ethnicity for their own ends. Guaranteeing women's rights in such a situation might be an even more demanding task, but there is a precedent in the experience of Somalia. In 1993, U.S. troops under U.N. command left a devastated and nearly ungovernable Somalia in which the rights of women were also systematically violated. But in August 2000, after 7 years of U.N. administration and failed negotiations, 25 women became members of Somalia's Transitional National Assembly. This January, the U.N. Security Council reaffirmed their commitment to peace in Somalia under that new government, a peace which is ironically being undermined by the U.S. seizure of Somali businesses since September 11th here in the United States. The dramatically improved status of women in Somalia was not a gift. Rather, it was the result of years of patient organizing by Somali women, supported by the international community, who built institutions led by women and involved them in the building of a civil society. Now, one of the Somali activists who helped to bring these women together is working with her sisters from Afghanistan and hoping they can learn from Somalia's experience. We're joined on the telephone now by Hibak Osman. She is a Somali-born women's rights activist and head of the Center for the Strategic Initiatives of Women, which has worked in Somalia since 1993. Her organization is helping to organize the first Afghan Women's Summit, which will take place this weekend in Brussels. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Hibak Osman.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you compare the situation in Afghanistan right now with what Somali women faced in 1993?
As a matter of fact, yes. After Siad Barre left Somalia, the Somali women's, the women's movement has not arrived in Somalia. And it was out of necessity that this woman came out of their houses to organize themselves. And they realized that it's only after they mobilize themselves that they can really make a difference in their own communities. That was purely out of necessity. And if you look at in Afghanistan today, women are also coming out, you know, out of necessity because they understand that if there is another, that if you, women's rights are not respected, that they are going to get another regime that has a contempt for humanity. And, you know, they also understand that political participation by women in leadership roles is absolutely essential to the to establishing a democratic regime in Afghanistan. So women do this out of necessity, not because they are interested in political positions, whereas men, take advantage of the war. They don't only create wars, but they also take advantage of the situations where they think it's a political bargain and who is going to take what and who's going to be what. You know, whereas women, it's really how they are going to get health for their children, how they are going to get education for their children, how they are going to survive.
We're talking with Hibak Osman, Somali-born women's rights activist. Can you describe how, though, in the last 7 years, women have built the women-led institutions in Somalia and increased your role in civil society?
It again. It really. It came once women realized that they had so much in common in terms of misery in Somalia, that the fact their children could not go to schools, they could not get health for their families, they did not have jobs, they did not have clean water. That is really the fact that they related to each other as human beings. That was the beginning of good things to happen for Somali women. That's when they realized that if they could speak in one voice, if they could organize themselves, they could help their communities. Because sometimes you will find a community, had a school and another community had the water, and they had to negotiate to help each other on this and to share, and the interdependency and between them was very important. That moved from doing community work into national level organizations and into international and regional organizations. And it was really, we heard all the miseries that the Somalis were going through from the women. And it was only when the women organized themselves through these organizations that we heard, what was happening and how the situation was in Somalia, and that we could support and help, that enable us to help them, yes.
I'm looking at a piece that my colleague Laura Flanders wrote. It's on her website, workingforchange.com, about you and about women in Somalia and comparing it to women in Afghanistan. She writes, in 1993, U.S. troops under U.N. command left a lawless and chaotic place. And then quoting you, she says, women were raped, buried alive, bombs were placed in their vaginas. The brutality was unimaginable. Then in August of 2000, the country welcomed a president and a parliament that represented the four main Somali clans, minority clans, and women. The initiative was the result of a three-month peace conference held in the neighboring state of Djibouti. There were few reasons for hope before the Djibouti conference. And she talks about all the earlier peace initiatives. So what turned it around?
It was the women started organizing themselves in 1993. I think the only time that you had all the Somalis meeting was when the women met together in 1993 from different clans, from different factions, and they came together to talk about, to make a difference in their own communities. They were not coming together to make a political statement. They came together as human beings, and they related to each other. And after that, it started, what happened was, you know, after they organized it so much, they went back and they did national workshops on peace, and they talked about peace and the importance of peace. And I think that really, that was the beginning of of civil society in Somalia. I mean, there was absolutely no history of institutions in Somalia. And I think for the first time, you had womenist organizations coming together, and that was the beginning of setting civil society institutions in Somalia.
We're talking to Hibak Osman, a Somali women's rights activist who is now headed to Brussels to help lead the first Afghan Women's Summit. Can you talk about what will happen there?
Yes, actually, we are co-conveners with Equality Now in New York and the Feminist Majority and FIDAY. And what we are doing is, again, like we did in Somalia, we are organizing to bring women from Afghanistan to Brussels to basically to create a neutral venue for them. To come and to talk and to really come up with declarations of exactly where, you know, how they are, to discuss their strategies and their visions for a new democratic Afghanistan. And that's all we are really trying to do. It's going to be up to the Afghan woman to really go back and make a difference in their own communities. We're just bringing them together and just creating the neutral venue for them. And I think it's very exciting, and it has been great working with them.
There have been some odd coming togethers of different women around the issue of Afghan women. For example, Laura Bush, the president's wife here, gave the first radio address by a first lady, by the wife of the president, a couple weeks ago. And she was talking about Afghan women and how important it is to support them and all that they've gone through. I mean, it was interesting considering earlier in the year, it was her husband's administration that had given $40 million to the Taliban. Of course, going way back, the Taliban and Osama bin Laden himself came to power in Afghanistan because of the help of the U.S. CIA with training and financing. Yet, as things turn around now, these issues of the brutality against Afghan women are being raised by this administration. What are your thoughts on that?
They are really doing all they can. I mean, things have changed since September 11, and I have been in meetings at the State Department, in fact, yesterday, last week, and there are all kinds of initiatives that are taking place. And, of course, at the forefront of these discussions is women's rights. But there are also concerns about women's rights and the commitment of the Netherlands Alliance and others, because every time you turn the TV on or you read the articles, you will find an opposition leader cautioning about women's rights, saying, well, we have to move it slowly. We are not sure exactly, you know, what we should really do. We have to be careful. And this is really, we are all having problems with this caution. And that's why it's important for this administration to really commit themselves to the women's rights. I mean, we are planning after the summit to bring women to Washington to talk and meet with the Hill, with Capitol Hill, to meet with Colin Powell and maybe the White House, and to really discuss what's at stake, because I think America is not ready to lose lives and to fight for a regime that has no respect for the fundamental rights of a woman, you know? And this is what that's why it's important to engage the administration and to engage the women's organizations and also civil society in this country to make sure that when there is a transitional government in Afghanistan, there is a commitment for women's rights. Right, the way things look at this point, even though there are a couple of women in Bonn, the discussions are not, of course, the women's rights discussions. Sima Wali is there, and I'm sure she's going to make sure that the women's rights are respected.
The RAWA has been excluded, the Revolutionary Association
No,
of
actually, they are there also.
Are they voting delegates?
Yes, I think they are, but this is political discussions. I think it's changed fortnight, but from what
it's
I
understand. It's been hard to really pin it down who exactly is there and actually allowed to participate.
Yeah, I think they are participating. I don't think any woman who is there is going to allow not to participate. And again, the eyes of the world are on this summit in Bonn, and I don't think the opposition would really make that mistake. I don't know how committed they are, Amy, and I'm really concerned about this. But they are, of course, saying that with caution that women's rights is at the forefront of these discussions, and it's going to be very important for the transitional government. But let me come back to this.
We just have 30 seconds.
Okay. I think it's extremely important that this government understands, the United States understands, that if this if that new government in Afghanistan does not respect women's rights, then they are not going to respect the essence of humanity or any human right, and therefore we have no business to be in Afghanistan in that case, you know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Hibak Osman, Somali women's rights activist headed to Brussels for the Afghan Women's Summit. Just as the U.S. CIA supported Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, they also supported Siad Barre, the longtime dictator of Somalia. And that wraps up our program for this hour. I want to let people know I'll be headed to Los Angeles today. Look forward to seeing people at Scripps College tonight at 7:30. And then tomorrow night, a big Democracy Now in Exile fundraiser with Danny Glover and Fire WBAI program director Bernard White. We'll all be there with a staff of KPFK and the band and the fire there in Los Angeles. We'll be at the First Baptist Church, 760 Southwest Moreland Avenue in Los Angeles. That's Saturday, December 1st, 7:30 to 10. Look forward to seeing everyone. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and as well, Suganya Mahendran. Our video team is Orlando Richards, Rachel Jones, Emily Kunstler. Jackie Suen is our webmeister, Corinna Escamilla, Noel Rabinowitz, Karen Renucci, as well as Dee Dee Halleck. Democracy Now! Can be reached by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks to KPFA, Amy Pomerlo, Aaron Glantz of Free Speech Radio News, KFCF in Fresno, all the Pacific affiliates airing Democracy Now! In Exile. We are Pacifica, broadcasting from downtown community television. Thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno, broadcasting on public access television cable access programs around the country. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the band and the fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Everybody say stop the war. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! In Exile.
Well, we have two very interesting debates going on in the media this week. One is about military tribunals, where actually there's a split in the elites and so both sides are being heard from. The other is torture, where we find, it seems, a dozen pundits throughout the media have been afflicted with a compulsion to talk about torture.
Today, a debate on military tribunals and torture between FAIR's Steve Rendell and Newsweek's Jonathan Alter. Then, an anti-abortion fugitive on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list says he's responsible for hundreds of anthrax threats sent to women's health clinics last month. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. warplanes continue to bomb the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar as U.S.-backed opposition forces move towards the southern city. In the eastern city of Jalalabad, local commanders say the U.S. government has promised military supplies, logistical support, and money to Mujahideen fighters in anticipation of an assault on what they say is an Al-Qaeda hideout in the White Mountains. As pressure mounts on the Taliban, many of the former regime's officials fled Kandahar for Pakistan, ostensibly to visit their families, but presumably with no intention of returning. The stories of rising defections came as the Taliban's supreme leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, ordered his followers to fight to the death to preserve control of Kandahar. The British Foreign Office yesterday ruled out an inquiry into the mass killings of Taliban prisoners during the riot at the Kalai Jangi Fort, despite pressure from Amnesty International and the United Nations. The incident left at least 400 people dead, at least 150 of them Taliban prisoners apparently executed by Northern Alliance troops while U.S. advisors were present. One of those advisors with the CIA was killed. There are some reports that the riot was possibly sparked by the two CIA men present beginning to interrogate the Taliban prisoners. Negotiations on Afghanistan's future were dealt a blow when a prominent Pashtun delegate walked out, charging that the ethnic majority Pashtuns was not given enough clout in the new administration. Haji Abdul Qadir was the most senior Pashtun figure in the delegation representing the powerful Northern Alliance and was central to efforts by the grouping, which is dominated by minority Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, to present itself as representative of the country's complex ethnic patchwork. Qadir's exit came as delegates entered the crucial phase of finalizing lists of delegates to a parliamentary-style Supreme Council, part of a UN blueprint that also provides for a cabinet-style interim administration. Hopes of an agreement were boosted yesterday when the Northern Alliance relaxed its earlier opposition to an international peacekeeping force being sent to Afghanistan. The UN Security Council met last night to agree on a revised plan for sanctions against Iraq amid controversy over U.S. threats to attack Iraq as part of the so-called war on terrorism. Russia, which has previously blocked British and U.S. proposals for what U.S. officials call smart sanctions against Iraq, backed a compromise deal under which a new list of the items controlled by sanctions will take effect in June. In the meantime, existing sanctions will continue. A bomb explosion on a bus in northern Israel has left at least four people dead, including the suicide bomber responsible for the attack. The latest attack comes on the fourth day of a mission to the region by U.S. envoys who are hoping to secure a ceasefire and implement a peace deal. Earlier yesterday, Israeli troops shot and killed two Palestinians at a roadblock in the West Bank, not far from the site of the bus attack. U.S. peace envoy General Anthony Zinni strongly condemned the Palestinian attack but said nothing about the killings by Israeli troops. The Justice Department announced yesterday that foreigners who give investigators useful information about suspected terrorists will be rewarded. Under the new so-called Responsible Cooperation Program, the Justice Department says it will defer deportation indefinitely for immigrants with visa problems and will allow outsiders to enter the country and apply for citizenship if they come forward and speak up. Arab groups and immigrants criticized the program. Marwan Kredi, executive director of the Philadelphia Arab American Community Development Corporation, said it's bribery and disgusting. It's what I would think some authoritarian government in the Middle East would do. President Bush yesterday defended his controversial plans to let military tribunals try non-citizens accused of terrorism and to let law enforcement officials detain and question thousands of foreigners in the United States. Bush brushed aside criticism of the measures, which have been widely condemned as violations of basic civil liberties, saying they would help protect freedom. And Attorney General John Ashcroft said yesterday that Clayton Wagner is the primary suspect in a wave of anthrax hoax letters sent to women's health clinics on the East Coast. Wagner claimed responsibility for some 300 letters delivered to the clinics last month when he showed up with a gun at the Georgia home of an anti-abortion activist last week. Wagner had previously been jailed on firearms and theft charges, testified at his trial that he had stalked clinics for months and stocked up on weapons after God asked him to, quote, be my warrior and kill doctors who provide abortion.
I look at you all, see the love that's sleeping, while my guitar gently weeps. I look at the floor and I see it needs sweeping. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told you how to unfold your love. I don't know how someone controlled you. They bought and sold you. I look at the world and I notice it's turning, while my guitar gently weeps. With every mistake we must surely be learning. Still my guitar gently weeps. I don't know how you were diverted. Perverted too. I don't know how you were inverted. No one alerted you. I look from the wings at the play you are staging,
while my guitar gently weeps, by Beatles' George Harrison. He died yesterday of lung cancer. He was 58 years old. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The collapsed state of Afghanistan appeared a step closer to getting a caretaker government, with the two main political factions attending UN peace talks and bonds, saying they were close to an agreement on how to share power for a few months at least. The framework of a deal was reportedly struck between the Northern Alliance, the dominant faction whose military commanders control most of the country, and the Rome-based group of exiles loyal to Afghanistan's aged former monarch Mohammad Zahir Shah. In a crucial U-turn, the Northern Alliance agreed to an international force to maintain security in Afghanistan after opposition to international troops being sent into the country. Britain and other European countries have proposed going into Afghanistan temporarily until a force made up of troops from Turkey, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries is formed. Failure to reach agreement on troops threatened to scuttle the talks. Other Afghan groups warned they would boycott the new government being proposed for Kabul because they feared for their safety from alliance troops, who are mainly Tajiks and control the city. Delegates reported progress in other areas. They said they were close to reaching agreement on the shape and membership of an interim government of Afghanistan. It would be Afghanistan's first ever broad-based government in history. and a history scarred by ethnic divisions. We turn now to Charles Michael Ray Inbon, correspondent for Free Speech Radio News, to describe the situation. Charles, can you just set the scene for us, Inbon? What does it actually look like? Where are you? Where are these talks taking place?
I'm on a boat right now on the Rhine River, which is right next to a main hotel where all the media have gathered. The talks themselves are on the Petersburg, which is up on a hill behind this small town just south of Bonn. The talks are in a very secure location. It's sort of like a castle, basically, on top of this hill that is surrounded by woods. And so it's, you know, very, very secure. No one is allowed in. I think only about 36, 37 journalists were allowed in for the opening. After that, it's all been closed off to the media entirely. So it's a very beautiful setting, very beautiful location for these talks, and a very secure location for the delegates who are up there talking.
Why are you on a boat? Are you taking the afternoon off?
No, the media center itself is on a boat on the Rhine, which is kind of interesting. The media center here was put together in about 2 days' time, I understand, and so they had this leftover boat, and they threw all of the equipment into it. So the actual UN press briefings that you all see on TV are actually on a boat on the Rhine River. So far in Bonn, of course, the meeting started on Tuesday. It was a day late. But once it got going, it looked like it started off with a lot of optimism by both UN officials and the four factions that are involved meeting here from Afghanistan. But now today, after a day of talks yesterday, people seem to be more sober, and now they're getting right down into the nitty-gritty of actually the talks and what they're going to be deciding. And so they're a little bit more reserved. It's been going kind of back and forth between optimism and hope that something positive can come out of this meeting and that a new government can be formed in Afghanistan. Right now they're working on forming, of course, the transitional government or a transitional administration that can be put in place in Afghanistan. While a new government is chosen, hopefully by a democratic process in Afghanistan within the next 2 years.
And this interim government, what does it look like it would be composed of?
Right now, that's what everyone is deciding. The four factions have decided they want to compose an interim government, but they haven't decided yet who's going to be involved in that interim government. The four factions meeting here are a group from the King's delegation in Rome, called the Rome delegation. The Cyprus delegation is another one of the delegations. The United Front, also known as the Northern Alliance, is one of the other delegations. And the Peshawar group is also one of the final delegations meeting here today. Of course, these four groups all have competing interests about how many of their leaders they want on, in the transitional government and in the new government. So that's kind of what's being worked out here. Whether this government will be a democracy, a republic, or what it will look like is still up in the air. It's very unclear yet. UN officials are pushing for a democracy, based on equality and freedom, and, of course, all those sort of things that we would hope would be involved in any sort of government, but that's all unclear as how it's going to come out in the end. All of the parties involved say they are for freedom, they are for women's rights, and they are for creating a new era of peace, they say, a new era of hope in Afghanistan. Whether this will come about is unclear at this time.
What about women and their role in the talks in Bonn?
There are women in the talks itself. The exact role they're playing is unclear. They say that they have a voice, that they are being heard. Still, several women's groups, such as the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan, have been excluded from these talks, haven't been allowed in. Many other women's groups say that there needs to be more work done on getting women involved here. Today, there was some positive involvement of the European women's leaders, a group of European women leaders from across Europe, one woman, the president of the Belgian Women's Council, another one, the head of the Equality Commission from the European Parliament, and the president of the German Women's Council, all spoke with the delegations in a special meeting to urge them to get women more involved in the conference, saying that women have to be involved in the forging of this new government, have to be involved in the forging of a constitution if women are going to be involved ultimately in the actual government that takes place. They were demanding a 40% involvement by women, a minimum to be fair in Afghanistan. Whether that will come about also is unclear at this time. However, all the parties involved have made statements that they are pro-women, or they are pro-having women involved. No one has come out to say in any of these delegations that they do not want to see women involvement. They all seem to be open to that. So there is some hope there that there will be some equality in this government.
Charles Michael Ray speaking to us from Bonn, where the Afghan transitional government talks are taking place. He is a reporter with Free Speech Radio News. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. As we turn here at home, the war at home, as law enforcement rounds up non-citizens, holds them in secrecy, and moves toward implementing the secretive military tribunals, the U.S. has begun to debate another method of pressing suspected terrorists, torture. There haven't yet been any presidential directives or pleas from the Attorney General to allow such extreme measures, but some FBI investigators have been itching for heavier tools in their interrogations of alleged 911 material witnesses. As one experienced FBI agent told the Washington Post, "We're known for humanitarian treatment, so basically we're stuck. It could get to that spot where we could go to pressure, where we won't have a choice, and we are probably getting there." After FBI agents are said to have offered the traditional inducements to the material witnesses, reduced prison sentences, money, relocation to the United States, new ID cards for themselves and their families if they cooperate, a surprising number of criminal experts say it's time to talk about letting interrogators inject key recalcitrant witnesses with truth serum, extraditing them to countries where authorities have no qualms about subjecting suspects to a ruthless third degree is another option. And while torture likely will remain officially off limits on U.S. soil, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, one of the country's leading civil libertarians, suggests creating a mechanism where U.S. judges could approve domestic torture warrants if they're convinced such tactics could thwart an imminent attack. In an article in the Village Voice this week, Dershowitz argues against military tribunals, but doesn't rule out torture as an option. Reporting in national newspapers about the previously unthinkable debate about coercive techniques of interrogation often centers on the reported silence of the men being held as material witnesses and the country's fear about new waves of terrorist attacks. We're joined right now by Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and Jonathan Alter, a columnist for Newsweek magazine. Jonathan Alter, let's begin with you. What about this discussion of torture?
Well, first of all, when people hear the word torture, a real red flag goes up, and it's almost as if once they hear it, they feel that any kind of nuanced discussion of it is somehow out of bounds. So my first interest in this is just to say, look, in a democratic society, we can talk about anything, including torture. I don't happen to favor physical torture. I just don't think it's consistent with American values. It's illegal and needs to stay illegal. But I do think that we can have a conversation about things like sodium pentothal, which doesn't have a terrific track record of success, but there are some newer drugs, so-called truth serums, which lead to a little less hallucination and might conceivably be more successful. And I think under the proper court supervision, it's at least worth talking about, weighing to see whether it might work. I noticed recently somebody brought to my attention that Justice Brennan, William Brennan, the great late civil libertarian on the Supreme Court, ruled some years ago that it was constitutionally acceptable to take an involuntary blood sample from a drunk driving suspect, for instance. So there is some precedent for involuntary use of an IV, which is what would be involved in trying to use some truth serum. But going further than that to physical abuse is something that I don't think we can do.
Steve Rendell of FAIR.
I think one of the really interesting things about this discussion is that it seems this torture talk seems to only have afflicted pundits. We do know that a couple of Justice Department officials who remain unnamed in the news have brought it up and said we have to consider the possibility, but otherwise this affliction only seems to affect pundits. Jonathan, actually, You do endorse torture. You just said in your piece on November 5th, you said that you were against legalizing torture in the U.S. You said that we should use legal forms of psychological torture here, and you suggested that we, quote, transfer some suspects to our less squeamish allies.
Well, I said that just so that people understand the full context. If you call something like what the United States did in Panama, where they played a lot of loud music outside the Vatican embassy where they thought Manuel Noriega was, if you call that torture, you can call it, you know, psychological warfare. You can call it psychological torture, if you will. Then I think that that's something that we can explore. You know, again, as I stated pretty clearly, I don't think this should be done outside of court supervision. As far as transferring people abroad, again, I think, you know, we're gonna face cases where it may be there's overlapping jurisdiction, and for instance, they've just seized an Indonesian with what they say, the authorities say, are some strong evidence of connections to the September 11th plot. I'm not sure it's out of bounds, verboten, somehow beyond the pale to suggest that, you know, perhaps the Indonesian authorities maybe should handle it. And what I object to is the notion that if you discuss any of this, if you say, look, this isn't going to be pretty, this is a wartime situation, that somehow in the eyes of Fair and some other critics engaged in reductionist thinking, that you're therefore a torturer or some kind of advocate of whacking people around using cattle prods on them. There are gradations, nuances in the discussion, and I think it's unfortunate to try to stifle them. Of course, it's limited to the pundit class right now, because if the president or somebody else were to get up and start talking about torture, that's not something that any of us would want. So
we have
of course
to,
it's going to be done by commentators.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're going to come back with Jonathan Alter of Newsweek on the telephone and Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy and Reporting in our Firehouse studio here on the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Walk with me, I'll walk with you, and so we will walk together, so we will walk together, so we will walk together. Walk with me, I'll walk with you, and so we will walk together as we march along. We are marching to Pretoria, Pretoria.
We are marching to Pretoria, the Weavers. Actually, just a few weeks ago, we had Ronnie Gilbert on the line talking about her experiences today with the group Women in Black, which is being investigated by the FBI and having been a target of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, in the 1960s, her group, the Weavers. And we are talking about torture and military tribunals with Jonathan Alter of Newsweek magazine and Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Well, Jonathan, I don't want to single you out. I mean, in the context that you used about transferring people overseas to our less squeamish allies, you did mention that Saudi Arabia uses beheadings. Now, that's not technically torture, but I just want to make sure that we have the context correct here. And the fact is, I'm glad to hear it if you're pulling back from your original position. But you're not alone. I mean, I was watching a couple of weeks ago, watching the McLaughlin Group, and 4 out of 5 of the panelists weighed in for some form of torture or another. John McLaughlin, Tony Blankley, Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC, Tony Blankley from the Washington Times, and Rich Lowry. Only Eleanor Clift dissented from the idea of bringing in some form of torture.
Well, see, that's a wonderful example of how, I mean, I think that, you know, FAIR is useful in this regard. I mean, if it's all reduced to, you know, John McLaughlin, thumbs up, thumbs down, torture yes, torture no, that is not a useful kind of political debate. But it's also not useful to say that anybody who, you know, breaks the taboo and dares to try to work through and make a reasoned, careful argument, steering around a lot of real legitimate barriers is somehow, you know, to be stigmatized for even raising the issue. I think is also not helpful. What you want is a lot of discussion. One of the things that I pointed out in my piece about torture, which almost nobody has noticed in their efforts to score political points on this particular story, is that torture usually doesn't work. You know, it's just setting aside the moral issues, it's ineffective, because what happens is when people are tortured, they to end the pain, they start to talk, but they usually don't tell the truth. And they can waste a lot of, you know, police time running around checking out leads that aren't true. And even with truth serum, which I, you know, as I said, I favor trying, oftentimes, you know, they get very chatty, but they don't necessarily provide anything useful. So there are a lot of not just moral but practical problems with torture. I quoted an Army colonel on the limitations and practical problems why it's not useful. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean we shouldn't sort of be discussing all of this without finger pointing about it all the time.
Well, I wasn't. I really reject this notion that somehow you're being persecuted on this.
We're having
a discussion. This is a debate. This is a kind of debate that should be going on all over the country
about a lot of
different issues where we're not having this debate.
Excellent.
And I'd want to point out that one of the things that you mentioned in yours, but this is just a way to get to Dershowitz, and Dershowitz has had this long-standing idea that torture isn't actually unconstitutional if you immunize the person you're torturing. In other words, the only reason he argues that torture would be unconstitutional is because it would erase the suspect's right against self-incrimination.
That's correct.
In fact, you know, I mean, that's a very narrow argument based on one narrow part of one amendment in the Bill of Rights. But in fact, torture is illegal. The United States signed, ratified, and executed the UN Conventions against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhumane, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment in 1994.
It goes back, it predates that, and as I stated clearly, and you quite correctly quoted me, I don't think that we should lift that legal prohibition. But one of the other things that Alan Dershowitz talks about, which I think is useful as an intellectual exercise, is what they call the ticking time bomb hypothetical, which is, you know, it's a good basis for say classroom discussion. It's something that they talk about in Israel quite a bit, where they debate this issue publicly and have now banned torture after allowing it to be legal, some forms of it for some years. But the ticking time bomb hypothetical is, what do you do if you capture, say, an Al-Qaeda member and he has knowledge of an ongoing a terrorist act, a bomb that's set to go off. He knows where it's going to go off and when. You know that he knows, and you need to try to get him to talk. It becomes a very interesting sort of moral dilemma. So I think the notion that these are kind of open and shut cases, and that you can draw a firm line in all circumstances, you know, as Abraham Lincoln quite persuasively wrote, and I think in some cases he went much too far during the Civil War. But these trade-offs between security and liberty are not as tidy and easy as some people would have us believe.
Well, I think we can. I think we can draw a pretty strong line on torture. The fact is that if we signed the torture conventions in 1994, we either meant it or we didn't. You don't sign things like a torture convention to scuttle them when the going gets a little rough. That convention reads, quote, "No exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. In addition, there is U.S. domestic law, which says that you may not torture. And both the convention and the U.S. domestic law says that you are equal to the torture if you transport or in any way cooperate with transporting somebody to be tortured anywhere else.
I think that's a fine law that I would agree with, and as I indicated in my column and have tried to make clear here, I think it's a good, important law. I think it's important to speak out against torture, but I also think you can't shrink from the hypothetical and say, well, that's just a hypothetical, because after September 11th, things that seemed completely out of our realm of consideration, that just were kind of pointless to even hypothesize about or discuss, are suddenly very much within the realm of the possible, and in the case of the World Trade Center, accomplished fact. So we can't just say anymore, well, that's just a hypothetical, don't bother me with that, that's just a silly intellectual exercise. It's not. It's something that we have to puzzle through, and we're not going to come to any easy answers. I'm not going to say, in every case, I'd be for torturing the person who knew where the ticking time bomb was. But I also think you can't say that it's something that we don't have to at least think about.
Jonathan Alter is on the phone with us from Newsweek, and Steve Rendell is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I thought it was interesting, Jonathan Alter, that you talked about an Indonesian suspect who's been arrested, and perhaps the Indonesians should do something to him in line with torture. I mean, certainly the Indonesian...
No, I'm not saying they should necessarily torture him, but maybe, I think there is a case to be made that sometimes if you have Muslims who are in detention, that perhaps the law enforcement directed against them should be Islamic justice. It might go down a little better in the Islamic world if the justice was meted out by other Muslims.
Is it really a religious thing, or is it more when it comes to torture, state terror? I mean, in the case of Indonesia, they're well known not for carrying out religious rites of torture, but the military state trained by the United States has killed and tortured hundreds of thousands of Indonesians, not to mention Timorese, so they certainly would be well positioned to do it to that guy.
Well, and that's an excellent point, given what they did in East Timor. And I'm not saying that, in this particular case, I don't know enough about this case, that I think they should ship this person back to be tortured. But I do think that as a political matter, I happen to favor, for instance, in the issue of international tribunals, of military tribunals, I think they should be international. I think it's very helpful for us to have other societies, particularly Muslim societies, involved in meting out justice. Now, if there are situations where this would be a detriment to the process, and it may well be that you're quite right in the case of Indonesia, then I wouldn't favor it. But I don't think that we should have kind of mental blocks in place saying nothing has to change, and nothing new in our approach to these issues should be on the table, that we should just proceed as if September 11th didn't happen. We have to free ourselves to think a little bit differently. Does that mean that we have to rationalize torture, advocate torture? No. And I think it's an oversimplification to say that people who want to broaden the discussion are advocating that. But we can try to think anew, as Lincoln said, about some of these issues. I
Jonathan
think in some
Alter.
Cases they've gone much too far in the Bush administration, but in other cases the response has been appropriate.
Jonathan Alter of Newsweek and Steve Rendell of Fair.
I don't want to single Jonathan out because, as I mentioned, it seems, I think the thing that's very curious about this is a couple of Justice Department officials speaking anonymously raise this issue, and then all the heavy lifting in the debate is done by pundits. Of course, we have Tucker Carlson at CNN on Crossfire on October 25th saying, quote, torture is bad. Keep in mind, some things are worse, and under certain circumstances, it may be the lesser of two evils, because some evils are pretty evil, close quote. You have Jay Winnick, a historian, writing in the Wall Street Journal's editorial pages, not exactly endorsing torture, but pointing out that in a case where a suspect was tortured in the Philippines, several atrocious criminal terrorist acts were averted. And he says, he argues, he ends up saying, one wonders, of course, what would have happened if the terrorist had been in American custody. What I find curious about this debate is that it only seems to be going on among pundits who seem to be taking a sort of anonymous official trial balloon and doing sort of all the heavy lifting of
I just, the issue. That's just not the way it works. I mean, it's not as if, it's not as if somebody from the government says, well, you know, you and the press can hoist this trial balloon and we'll see if it goes over, and then maybe we can go ahead and push through our terror agenda, our torture agenda. The way it works is that, you know, you're writing a column, you're trying to provoke some discussion and be provocative, get conversations like this one going, and so you tease out the arguments. And the only part of it, and I like people engaged in critical debate and criticizing it, the only part of it that is annoying to me is when some organizations, and the FAIR newsletter would be included in this, you know, take one sentence from the article, put it in their newsletter, and stigmatize the author as an advocate of torture. And that doesn't help.
Well, let me ask you something.
Distinctions between psychological interrogation and physical torture, and some of the, and include some of the nuances involved, including some of the strong problems, moral and practical, of torture.
Jonathan Alter, not referring to your article, but what you just said, talking about this discussion of torture, it seems that people have a mental block against it. Are you suggesting that human rights, as identified and protected by international treaties, are a mental block?
No, I'm not. And I was just down interviewing the head of the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and I'm very supportive of those kinds of efforts. What I object to is this notion that if you open the conversation, that somehow the American people and other people interested in public affairs around the world cannot be trusted to work through the nuances. Because the subtext of the criticism of those of us who have been opening this conversation is that it's a slippery slope, and once you start talking about it, you legitimize it, and you give aid and comfort to the guys with hoods on their head who want to crush people's skulls. And instead, what we're trying to do is just say, no, nothing in wartime, and maybe we could have a discussion about whether you think we're in a war. I do. Nothing in wartime is off the table for public discussion.
As a practical point, how do you expect countries to cooperate with the U.S. in investigations if we even put torture on the table for discussion? Spain's already refusing to extradite people that they have arrested because of military tribunals and the death penalty here in the United States.
Well, that's a real problem that the Bush administration has. And I think we're learning a hard lesson about our support for the death penalty, which I oppose. It will lessen international cooperation. It will lessen international cooperation if we have these military tribunals as presently constituted, and that's one of the reasons why I strongly think they have to change, and we need to adjust that. But if international cooperation is lessened because in our press we discuss torture in any fashion, let me just finish the point. The onus is then on those who criticize us for having a democratic discussion about everything.
But you're not just talking about discussing it. You're talking about discussing it as a means to decide whether or not to engage in it in this country.
Well, no. I am talking about whether or not to engage in the use of sodium pentothal and some psychological torture, if you will, psychological techniques, which I draw a big distinction between that and physical torture. Now, other people can say, and my my friend at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights says, you know, I think you were absolutely right to just fine to open this all for discussion. He happens to reject my distinction between physical and psychological torture, and that's fine. That's all part of the conversation. But what I reject is the notion that if you try to draw such distinctions and say, well, hey, sodium pentothal is not the same as a cattle prod or whatever kind of distinction one wants to draw, that therefore you are somehow crossing some boundary in of legitimate public discussion. And if other nations object to us crossing such boundaries, crossing such free speech boundaries, and want to cooperate less with us as a result of that, they need a better understanding of our vivid, robust public debate in the United States. And that is their concern, not ours. Now, obviously, I think it is helpful to, well, actually, some people in the human rights movement have said, you know, this actually helps us in a sense, because when you open up the conversation of torture, you get to the failures of torture and why torture doesn't work, which is one of the things that I was trying to explain in my piece. And you get people's first reaction, their emotional, frustrated reaction after September 11th, in a lot of cases in the United States, is, well, let's torture them. And then if you say, well, hey, I understand the impulse, but there's problems A, B, C, and D with doing this, then their second reaction is a more measured one. And
Steve Rendell.
That should be productive.
But it's important to point out that in international law and international legal tradition, that torture, along with genocide and a very small number of other crimes against humanity, are considered among the highest of crimes, the most atrocious of crimes. Do I have time to mention the military tribunals? Because I think we'll find a little more agreement on this.
You have just 1 minute because we're just about wrapping up.
Just let me say that I think that it's a very interesting debate that's happening about military tribunals. 2 days ago on Wednesday, Senator Leahy came out and was quite critical of this presidential directive. In fact, 2 weeks ago when Bush first proposed this and first signed the executive order, it was very clear that there was a split in the elites and that we were going to have a real debate like we haven't had on any other issue having to do with the military since September 11th. We had no debate about the bombing, but it was early on that we had William Safire in the New York Times referring to the military tribunals as kangaroo courts. You had Republican politicians like Bob Barr in Georgia very squeamish about the idea. So because there was a split within the elites, because there are Republicans, Democrats, columnists of all stripe arguing about this, we actually get a debate. I think that's a good thing for military tribunals, but I think it also tells us something about why we don't get to have a debate on other things, such as bombing major cities and those sorts of issues.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up as we move on to our last segment, which has to do with terrorism at home, and that is the anthrax threats around this country. And the Justice Department finally, in a news conference, naming Clayton Wagner and saying they believe he is responsible for some of the threats at hundreds of women's health clinics around the country. We have been joined by Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can go to that website at fair.org, and Jonathan Alter of Newsweek. And they are at, is it newsweek.com?
Newsweek.com is one way to get us. We're on the newsstand.
Thanks both very much. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Oh, trust in me. Oh, I'll trust in you. Oh, trust in me. Suspicious.
Suspicious, Tent City, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-abortion fugitive Clayton Wagner, one of the FBI's 10 most wanted people, is taking credit for a rash of fake anthrax letters sent to family planning clinics in October. The FBI seems willing to at least consider his claim. Yesterday, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced Wagner had been named by the Bureau as a top suspect in the anthrax hoax. The FBI said Wagner, a self-described anti-abortion warrior, is extremely dangerous. He said he has survival skills and may be heavily armed, not unlike the description of suspected terrorist Osama bin Laden. Wagner was added to the FBI's 10 most wanted list 10 days after the attacks of September 11th. Yesterday, though, was the first time the attorney general had spoken about the anthrax threats received by over 450 women's health clinics and pro-choice organizations in at least 12 states since September 11th. Although all the envelopes tested negative for anthrax, pro-choice advocates say they've been targeted by a case of extreme domestic terrorism. Abortion clinics have been targeted by snipers, bombs, arson attacks, butyric acid attacks, and anthrax threats for decades. Pro-choice groups yesterday said they're heartened by Ashcroft's denunciation of those responsible for anthrax threats, but cautioned that the investigation should also focus on the network of individuals aiding and abetting Wagner, especially the extremist anti-abortion group Army of God. They also urged the Army of God be designated as a domestic terrorist organization by the Justice Department. We're joined by Vicky Saporta, Executive Director of National Abortion Federation. Do you expect the Army of God to be put on the domestic terror list?
We certainly hope that they will be. They need to be named as a terrorist organization. They vocally advocate the murder of abortion providers and using fatal force to advance their political agenda somehow in the name of God. And so we think it's important that they be treated as the domestic terrorist organization that they are.
Frederick Clarkson, how unusual is it? Frederick Clarkson is author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, and you worked at Planned Parenthood working on researching the right wing. How unusual is it that the Attorney General John Ashcroft, an avowed anti-abortion activist himself, actually finally said that women's health clinics were threatened in this country?
Well, it's a first for him, that's for sure. I think he's been protecting his right flank politically in not wanting to offend his base constituency in the Christian right. And on the other hand, he's really alarmed people that he may be holding a double standard of justice. I think that the good news is that everybody below John Ashcroft has been quite concerned and quite vigorous in trying to find Clayton Wagner.
Well, we have been encouraging the Attorney General to come out with such a statement because we thought it was important that anti-choice extremists know that he's taking these threats very seriously so that we won't have a third wave of threats, because we don't know when these letters will cease to be hoaxes and when they'll really begin containing anthrax, because those active in the Army of God have said that they wouldn't hesitate to use anthrax if they really had it. And then hundreds of people will be put at risk, not only abortion providers, but those who are delivering the mail and the packages and emergency response teams. And it's important that those individuals understand how seriously the Justice Department, the FBI, and other law enforcement officials are taking these anthrax threat letters.
Vicky Saporta, what did it take to get Ashcroft to finally deal with women's health clinics that provide abortion?
We have been asking for a meeting with him since early in the summer, when we saw an increase in activity outside of clinics, more aggressive picketing, more criminal activity. And we know how important law enforcement response is to calming things and to decrease the escalation we saw in violence. We've asked for a meeting with him on more than one occasion, and this week we met at the Justice Department with his deputy and others from the FBI and the U.S. Marshals and the task force, because, again, we think that it's important that he came out with a strong public statement. And we've also asked for any number of things through the summer when Wagner escaped, and in the summer when he made the threats on the Army of God's website that he would murder anyone working in or around abortion clinics. We thought it was important to get more resources into the investigation and offer a reward so that he could be apprehended before he carried out his threats to murder an abortion provider. And we were pleased when the FBI did put him on the 10 most wanted list. The marshals already had them on their 10 most wanted list, as did the ATF. But with his placement on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, more resources did go into the investigation. A reward has been offered. And these are all very important steps to serve as a deterrent for others who may want to do copycat crimes. They need to know how seriously law enforcement officials are taking these threats, and that, you know, people are going to go to jail for the rest of their lives, some of them for the threats that they've been making in their criminal activity.
Vicki Saporta with National Abortion Federation. Carol Mason is also on the line with us, professor of American Studies at Hobart William Smith College and author of the forthcoming book, Killing for Life, the Apocalyptic Narrative of Anti-Abortion Politics. Professor Mason, according to Neil Horsley, the self-described abortion abolitionist and founder of the web-based Nuremberg Files hit list and creator of the Christian Gallery News Service website, Wagner suddenly appeared at his Georgia home last Friday afternoon. Horsley wrote online, "I turned to look at the door to my office just as the form of a man filled the doorway. In one motion, he pulled back his coat to show me a large holstered firearm, while simultaneously he commanded me to hold the dog. I obeyed. 'You don't recognize me, do you?' he stated, and then stopped. 'I'm Clay Wagner.'" Carol Mason, can you talk about Clayton Wagner and this terrorist campaign, who he is and who Horsley is?
I think Wagner is a very dangerous man. There's no doubt about that. And I think his going to Neil Horsley is definitely to get some publicity and to make it known that he's on this campaign. I think that it's important to realize that Wagner's ideas, however, are not the product of a lone, crazed, fringe lunatic, but are derived from some anti-abortion campaigns targeting clinic workers since 1992. We've had anti-abortionists who've targeted clinic workers with what the anti-abortionists themselves called guerrilla legislation. And the fact that Wagner wants people to quit their jobs, the language that he's put his demands in, shows me that he's operating under some of these same ideas. He's not targeting just doctors, and although there have been anti-abortion campaigns to target doctors with what they call guerrilla legislation and lawsuits, Wagner is specifically, and this is on Horsley's website, is specifically saying that doctors have protection and that he's going after the clinic workers who don't have so much protection, and saying that if they want to escape his wrath, if they want to escape being murdered, that they should go to Horsley's website and post some information telling that will help validate or confirm to Wagner that they've quit their jobs. And what this means is one of two things: either that Wagner has a very sophisticated database on which he could confirm this information, and that's what he has claimed. But it also means that it could be that he's trying to compile a database of clinic workers to be targeted either by violent means, the murders that he's saying that he will commit, and I think he's a credible person, I think we should believe that, either by violent means or by nonviolent anti-abortion campaigns that do terrorize people and harass people but are considered nonviolent and non-terroristic.
Can you talk about what exactly Clayton Wagner has done at this point, and any kind of comparisons of here we're bombing Afghanistan, putting all resources, the U.S. government, into finding Osama bin Laden. Yet here you have Clayton Wagner on the top 10 FBI list, domestic terrorist, who it is clear he was in Georgia just in the last few days. And the U.S. government can't find him, can't find, what was his name, Eric Rudolph,
right.
Who it's believed was responsible for a number of bombings.
Right. I think it's good that you link this with Eric Rudolph, because it's clear to me that being on the web so much, having this meeting with Horsley got him a lot of attention, and he's very much trying to narrate himself in terms of Eric Rudolph, who was seen more or less as a folk hero, not as a martyr, but as a sort of a fugitive. And I think he's definitely sort of doing the same thing that that Eric Rudolph's case did, which was sort of to show the FBI's incompetence and to thumb his nose at the federal law enforcement. And in doing so, he's very much trying to draw on this idea to get the people behind him, to get Americans behind him, to help him out, and possibly to inspire other people to take up arms and to do their own vigilante or guerrilla actions.
I want to thank you very much for being with us and all of our guests. We're going to certainly continue to follow this issue. Carol Mason, professor of American Studies, Hobart William Smith College. Frederick Clarkson, author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. And Vicki Saporta, executive director of the National Abortion Federation. And that does it for this program today. I'll be headed to Los Angeles. I'll be at Scripps College tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night with Danny Glover and Fire WBAI program director Bernard White, along with a number of people from KPFK, the Fire, the band, as well as current staff. We'll be showing the video highlights of Democracy Now! In Exile. And we'll be in Los Angeles at the First Baptist Church, 760 South Westmoreland Avenue. You can get the latest information on that, again, with Danny Glover, tomorrow night, 7:30 to 10, at our website, as you can get links to all of our guests and information on the program at democracynow.org. Jackie Suen is our webmeister. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendran. Our video team, Orlando Richards, Rachel Jones, Emily Kunstler, Karen Ranucci, Corinna Escamilla, Noel Rabinowitz, and Dee Dee Halleck. Thanks to Amy Pomerlo at KPFA, KPFA staff in general, and KFCF in Fresno, Pacifica affiliate stations around the country who are airing Democracy Now!. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting from Downtown Community Television, a firehouse in Chinatown in Manhattan, thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno, broadcasting on public access TV stations around the country in New York, Manhattan Neighborhood Network on Channel 56 and Channel 34, CUNY TV, as well as on Dish Network, Channel 9415. That's Free Speech TV's 24-hour channel. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.